you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 199 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your host once again. Hey, we're just one away from episode 200. Today, I have a very special guest, Janet Falk. Janet is a public relations and marketing communications consultant or expert out of the New York area. And we have literally a fascinating discussion about how to use public relations and public relation communications to your advantage to help build and grow your law practice. And she touches on a lot of subjects with some really great suggestions and material talking about how to find publications that are interested in what you have to say and write as an attorney, how you can use the power of LinkedIn to further amplify your message. And one particularly poignant discussion that I thought has to do with how to memorialize your speaking engagements and use the power of photography to amplify the voice that you have at a speaking engagement. So it's really an interesting discussion, and I hope you learn as much from it as I did. So without any further delay, here is Janet Falk. Janet Falk, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
My pleasure, Neil. I'm excited to be here and to talk to your listeners, solo attorneys and those with a small firm practice and their friends.
Yes, and I'm delighted to have you here. So with that, by way of introduction, tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Certainly. I am a public relations and marketing communications professional, and I focus on attorneys and other business professionals. Previously, I worked at a public relations agency whose principal client was one of the Am Law 50, and my job was to get those attorneys in the news as often as possible. Before that, I had worked at other public relations agencies. I had worked at nonprofits, and I had worked at on Wall Street. So you can see I have a very eclectic career. I call myself not a round peg and not a square peg, but an octagonal peg because I have worked in so many different industries with companies and nonprofits, large and small. In order to facilitate changing direction from time to time, I have taken classes in public relations and marketing so that I would have the credibility and the credentials and be able to network to find my way into those new positions. And finally, I have a PhD in Spanish literature and taught at the college level. So you can see my career is quite varied over the years.
Muy bueno. You know, there's a lot of, as you say, in your octagonal peg, there's a lot of facets to your career. One of the things I think is interesting, you know, frankly, PR professionals are, there's a lot of them around. And we try and sometimes mash that square peg into the round hole when it comes to the legal space. I think you are one of the very few who devote a significant amount of your practice, probably because of your background, to the legal market. How is the legal market different, say, than from other professional services or other public relations clients?
I think you always are looking, Neil, at who is on the other side of the table and what is it that they care most about. So attorneys are addressing several different audiences when they are talking to the media or promoting their services through marketing activities, speaking engagements, publishing articles, and the like. So the first audience that they're looking at are, of course, potential clients. But then they also want to be in touch with their referral sources, who might be other attorneys who are conflicted and cannot handle a particular matter. Or they might not be confident of their ability to move between intellectual property and personal injury and trust and estates. So they refer the business to someone else. There are other referral sources in other professional capacities. So when you think about attorneys and the content that they are delivering to specific audiences across different platforms, I find that's a place where they differentiate themselves from other professional services providers and from other businesses and, you know, corporations and so forth.
You know, I think for the most part, a lot of attorneys, in particular, particularly small firm and solo practitioners, when they think of legal public relations, you know, they think of seeing that one attorney who gets called to appear in a 2-minute spot on the local news, or if they're really fortunate, you know, on a national broadcast. And I know attorneys look to themselves and think, I don't know that I could do that, or why would anybody come to me for that? So obviously, there's a whole lot more breadth to the concept of public relations for attorneys than simply, you know, getting that coveted spot on a news broadcast. So what are some of the other areas that attorneys should be considering as part of the public relations spectrum?
Well, before I get into that, Neil, I'd like to address something, which is, yes, it is very glamorous and one could even say sexy. Yep. to be quoted in a news broadcast. But let me ask you, if I didn't see that news broadcast and it wasn't captured in a clip that's on the station's website, that news broadcast didn't happen for me.
Yeah, tree in the forest. Right.
Right. So I would encourage your audience to think that there are many other media outlets where people probably are more engaged and are looking for resources.
Sure.
For example, there's the industry media. There is a publication for every business sector. And you wouldn't believe how tiny some of those business sectors might be. I had a client who was an employment attorney and a litigator, and he focused on the difference between employees and contract workers. Mm-hmm. And specifically, he was looking at the pizza industry. And pizza restaurants, as you may recall, have drivers who mostly work the late afternoon shift and the evening shift, and they're delivering pizzas to the customers of the restaurant. And there are at least 4 pizza industry magazines where I was able to place this attorney talking about the criteria that a pizza restaurant owner must use to determine that a worker is not an employee, but a contractor. And it relates to who owns the car and who does the maintenance and who decides the route and so on and so forth. So I would encourage your listeners to think more broadly about the media than simply the national news or the local television broadcast, and to think instead about the industry media, which is where their potential clients are going to be looking for information. Then there's the business media, and that could be any number of publications. Often there's a city business publication, like Crane's New York Business or Pittsburgh Business Journal, something like that. And then there's the local general newspaper. And then there are other local online publications that are serving a particular geographic market. So whether your focus is consumer practice or it's business, commercial practice, then you should be thinking about the multiple news outlets where your potential clients and referral sources are looking for information so that they can save time, save money, and make more money. Because if only they knew what you know, Neil, about a particular aspect of the law, as I mentioned, the difference between employees and contract workers, then they would keep themselves out of litigation and they would save time and save money. So having said all that about media relations, I would point out that media relations is only one part of the work that I do as a public relations consultant.
Okay.
I look at a law firm's website and how it is that they are presenting themselves to the marketplace, whether it's potential clients or referral sources. I look at the newsletter, and many law firms don't have a newsletter, something that they should have at least quarterly so that they can be getting their name under someone else's nose and being in touch with people. I look at whether they're speaking at local events and how they could be getting themselves in front of whether it's industry groups or whether it's the local business organizations. I look at whether they're in touch with local political officials, because you want to be a friend of theirs, maybe not necessarily a donor, but you want to be on their radar because it may be that sometime down the road, you're going to need their help with a particular issue. So there are other ways that attorneys can be reaching out to the general public, to their referral sources, to potential clients that go well beyond the work that they're doing to introduce themselves to reporters. And certainly I can help them with all of the above.
Well, it's a tremendous revelation, I think, for me and for a lot of folks on listening on the podcast today, that there's almost, it seems to me from what you just described, almost an infinite number of outlets to which you could be marketing your practice, your firm, your skills, that would benefit you in untold ways. So it kind of leads me to my next question. You know, is this something that a solo practitioner could take advantage of, or something that a small 2 or 3 person firm could take advantage of, or do you have to have some level of size to make it worth your while in terms of the expenditure of the overhead to address this challenge?
I can work with firms of any size. I have a number of clients who are solo practitioners, and I have other clients who are at firms that are fewer than 50 attorneys. So I think that any attorney should look at their practice and should think, who is it that I need to be in touch with? Where are they looking for information? How can I get in front of them? And how much non-billable time am I willing to invest in this kind of activity? I would point out, Neil, that communications, whether it's public relations, media relations, marketing, whatever you want to call it, communications is an investment. It is not an expense.
Sure.
Because no one is going to do that work for you. Do you honestly think that your clients are going to actively promote you? Of course not. They're busy running their own business. So when you consider that your practice is requiring this level of investment, then you have to think, who is the best person to do this? Do I have time in my busy day with everything else that I'm trying to do with my client work to take this on? And basically, there's 3 ways to handle this kind of activity of communications. The first way is to do what you've been doing, right? And that means basically you're not doing anything at all because you're focused on your practice, right? The second thing is to make an effort to do it on top of everything else that you're doing. But you're going to be teaching yourself best practices in communications at the same time that you're running your own legal practice. How's that going to work out? And then the third way is to hire a professional, someone who is in touch with the marketplace, who understands best practices, and will take the weight of the world off your shoulders while they deliver this service on your behalf, so that you can focus on what you really want to do, which is practice the law. So let me ask you, Neil, are you your own plumber?
Right. No. You know, it's really interesting because, we hear the similar argument made on behalf of other marketing type specialists or business coaches, that there's always an advantage and a force multiplier created by bringing in a professional who can shorten that learning curve or eliminate that learning curve or take on that learning curve on your behalf rather than you doing it yourself. Is there a way to segregate public relations from other marketing endeavors? Is there a way to carve out a role for just a public relations coach or advisor? Or are they so intrinsically woven together that it doesn't make sense to try and segregate it?
I think you can focus on one aspect of communications over another, but ultimately you want everything to be synchronized and to be working together. If I introduce an attorney to a reporter, I want to make sure that that website is top notch and that LinkedIn profile is up to snuff, because the reporter is not going to exclusively take my word as that attorney is a credible and reliable source. They're going to check out that attorney, take a look at her website, take a look at his LinkedIn profile. And so if they are not consistently saying the same kinds of things, then which one is the reporter going to believe? My pitch, the LinkedIn profile, or the website? So all pieces of your communications activities should fit together.
It has to be congruent.
Right.
Yeah, I can see that for sure. Just kind of putting it into my own experience so that by way of illustration, if I have an estate planning practice and I largely devote it to young couples or young professionals just getting started in their careers and with their families and that kind of thing. So if I wanted to market to that segment of the community, following your advice, I have to think about, what publications do these folks read? What websites do they visit? What groups do they belong to? All those types of things. Kind of figuring that out is a full-time job in and of itself. So to me, it makes sense that if I want to start and get my content or my information in front of those types of audiences, to me, it makes a ton of sense to bring on somebody who can readily identify what those resources might be.
Right, right. And here's another way of looking at it, Neil. I know what is newsworthy and what is not, right? So say you've moved offices. Well, that's great. You can get that in the local law journal. Maybe you can get it in the local business news journal. But you're not going to get it in the industry news, and it's certainly not going to be on national TV. So I know what is newsworthy. I know how to professionally introduce you to a reporter so that they will see you as a reliable, authoritative, and accessible resource who can talk about these three topics that are very timely and have a bottom line impact. And we'll make sure that the reporter understands that if only readers know what Neil Tyron knows, then they will save time, save money, and make more money. And that could be for individuals of a certain stripe. As you say, you focus on young families. That could be for companies. Companies might want to provide a service like yours to their employees as a benefit, as a way of retaining their employees. There are many perks that come along with working for certain employers, and legal services for planning your demise and the disposition of your assets would be an interesting benefit, I am sure, to some companies. So it may be individuals, it may be companies, it may be corporations. So I know what is newsworthy. I know how to present an attorney as a credible, reliable, and authoritative and accessible source. And I know how I can make you quotable and memorable. Because if you have a conversation with a reporter, and the reporter has a conversation with another attorney, and that person gets into the article and you don't, why is that? Right? So you not only have to be authoritative, you not only have to be reliable, you have to be quotable. And if you can do that on your own, great. But I'm not sure that you can.
How much does image play in this role? And I think of, without naming names, but a prominent attorney who always wears the same color, and that factor works into all of their public relations communications. Is that important, or is that overdone, or where on the spectrum does that lie?
I'm not sure I know who you're referring to, so I'm going to let that go by. Let me say this. I go to many a networking event.
Sure.
And when I go to a networking event, one of my strategies is, before I walk into the room, I have contacted the leaders of the organization to say, I'm so looking forward to coming to your networking event. I'm a public relations professional. I'm thinking of joining your organization. And when they respond to me by email, then I let them know that I'm going to be wearing a pink jacket or a red jacket or something on that mm-hmm. order. I don't wear black or navy or gray when I walk into a room. I want people to remember that they've met me. And as a public relations professional, I have the ability to wear a colored jacket, especially as a woman. Now, I don't think, Neil, that you would be able to wear a red jacket when you walked into a room if it wasn't a holiday party.
Sure.
But what you can do is you can wear a red pocket square, or you can wear a green tie, and you will still be in your gray suit looking like a professional attorney, but you will have some identifying color that a person will remember. Oh yeah, I remember him. He was wearing that red pocket square, or he was wearing that green tie. So in terms of image, if you're talking about professional appearance, yes, there are some things that you can do that will make you more noticeable mm-hmm. and more memorable. I hope that answers the question.
It does. It does. Because, again, I think, you know, just based on my own understanding and proving how ignorant I am, there's a tendency to kind of pigeonhole what public relations and public relations communications are all about. It's not all about just, as we said, it's not all about just getting on the local news. It's not all about always wearing red whenever you're in the on the courthouse steps. But image does play a role. And to the extent that you can incorporate that imagery into a coherent, you know, presentation across all the platforms that you've talked about, then it helps to make you an identifiable source.
Right, right. Well, let me give you an example. I had as a client Staten Island Legal Services, and they provide services to people on a low-cost or no-cost basis. Mm-hmm. They were having their first fundraising event, and the executive director was a woman, and she did not dress very formally in the office. I asked her what she was planning to wear at this major fundraising event, and she said, I bought a new skirt suit and it's brown. And I said, no, you cannot wear that. And she said, but it's a skirt suit. And I said, it's brown. You are going to be in a room with a lot of people wearing black and navy suits. I have to be able to find you. We're going to have a photographer, and I need to make sure that you are in all the photographs. If you're wearing a brown suit, I won't be able to find you. What else do you have in your closet? And she said, I have a camel pantsuit. And I said, that's perfect. because camo would stand out in that room. Now, the honoree of that luncheon was a woman who was a retired judge. I should mention also that the person who appointed her to the bench was former Governor Mario Cuomo, who was much beloved in the community, even though he was a Democrat and Staten Island is a Republican bastion. So what do you think this judge wore, knowing she was going to be in all the photographs?
Purple.
She did. She wore royal purple.
Really?
So if you're right. Very good guess, Neil. You are the first person in 6 years of telling this story that has gotten the color right. So she understood that she was going to be in a lot of photographs. And even though she was 6 feet tall, she wanted to make sure that people recognized her in the photographs. And so she wore purple. And as I said, the executive director wore camel so that she would stand out in the room and I could find her to make sure that she was in all the photographs.
You started your law practice to ditch the firm life and be your own boss, but your practice is running you. The good news, being an attorney entrepreneur doesn't have to be this hard. Jesse and Megan, the lawpreneurs behind Jurisdiction, are working to build a new generation of solo practitioners who love being lawyers. This year, Jurisdiction is introducing a new program, Next Level Law Practice. Next Level Law Practice is a rigorous training program that provides the tools and business fundamentals for estate planning attorneys to start and grow a profitable and streamlined legal business. Next Level Law Practice gives you access to videos, worksheets, templates, one-on-one coaching, and live group sessions that allow you to ask questions and learn on your own schedule. To learn more about the program, visit thrivejd.com. That's thrivejd.com. They're even offering an exclusive coupon code for the Law Entrepreneur listeners. Just enter the code TLE150, that's like the Law Entrepreneur 150, for a $150 discount off your course registration. And welcome to the show, Jurisdiction. Support for today's episode comes from Ruby Receptionists, dedicated to helping you grow your practice one happy caller at a time. From their offices in Portland, Oregon, Ruby's live remote receptionists create an exceptional experience for your callers by answering calls live with your custom greeting, delighting callers in English or Spanish, transferring calls, taking messages, collecting new client intake, and much more. Just like an in-house receptionist at a fraction of the cost. For 15 years, Ruby has been turning rings into relationships. For more information, call 844-895-7829 or visit callruby.com/lawentrepreneur. Shifting the discussion here a little bit, you mentioned this a while ago, and I want to circle back to it because I know you've actually written pretty extensively about the role of LinkedIn and your profile on LinkedIn as a professional gateway to your practice. And I know for most attorneys, social media is not something they spend a lot of time on, although I don't really understand why. But they think, well, I got Facebook for my private life and I have LinkedIn for my professional life, and they treat the two the same. And I gather from your writings that that's a misguided belief.
Right. I think if you're not on LinkedIn, then you're not in business. So if you're going to be on LinkedIn, you should do it in a professional way that's consistent with everything else that you do. And that means providing up-to-date information about your experience and your activities, and including all the elements that LinkedIn makes available to you. For example, the background of your photo should be not the true blue LinkedIn, but something that is indicative about your practice. You can use a word cloud, or you could have references to materials that you make available on your website. I think it's very important to give something away with your branding on it on your website so that people can download it and then they can share it with somebody else or print it out, read it for more study later. So that's one area where you can improve is what's in the background. I think putting the scales of justice or the courthouse steps up there makes you look like everybody else. Why bother? Then you can have other media on your LinkedIn profile. You can have articles that you've published. You can have video recordings or podcasts in which you have participated. And those will give a fuller picture of who you are and why a person would want to talk to you, attorney, and not your colleague down the hall or your competitor across town. Then in terms of your activity on LinkedIn, if you're going to post from time to time, you should be aware that LinkedIn only likes to see your posts every 3 or 4 hours. So if you're posting 3 or 4 things, try and spread them out over a day or two so that it's not going to be lost. Only 9% of the people you are connected to on LinkedIn will see anything that you post as activity. So you have to post something several times in order to make sure that more people are going to see it. And as I said, you have to space it out over a period of time. If you're going to be speaking at an organization, then I encourage you to do the following. First, you announce, very excited to speak about trust and estate planning for young families at the name of organization. I will discuss topic A, topic B, topic C, and then you include the link so that people can find out more information about the event and register. Now, what happens, Neil, when I see that one of my connections is going to be speaking at an event? I think, wow, Neil Tyra is speaking about trusts and wills for young families. I ought to go to that event. Or maybe I'll think, Neil Tyra is speaking about this. I ought to learn more about this subject. Let me take a look at that website. Mm-hmm. Or I might think, Neil Tyra is speaking about wills. Gee, too bad I can't go. I have another event that night. But maybe I can invite Neil to speak at our group. Now, first you promote the event. And then after the event, you take a picture of yourself in conversation with someone else at the event. It could be the organizer. It could be someone who asked a question. But a picture of you at the podium, to me, is meaningless. It just means you stood in front of the room. I want to see you interacting with someone. Then I'll know that you are approachable and accessible and want to share your information. So after you have appeared at this event, you do the same thing. You say, great questions from the audience on the topics of topic one, topic two, topic three. You know, looking forward to my next event or at this organization or keeping in touch with this organization or something like that. So the idea is that your activity on LinkedIn should be value added and should drive people to want to know more about you by going to the event, by going to your website, or maybe considering that you would be a good speaker at their group. Finally, people like to publish articles on LinkedIn because there's no editor. You are the editor, and you can write as much and as long as you want. But when you publish an article on LinkedIn, you have to make sure that you also promote it. So LinkedIn has a mechanism that when you write an article, and right before you publish it, it asks you for information so that you can make a post about it, just as you have posted that you are speaking at this event or that you spoke at the other event. When you're commenting on someone else's post on LinkedIn because you found it helpful or informative, don't say congratulations or great idea or I agree, because there's no value there to the reader. If I see that Neil Tyra commented on an article that someone else has posted on LinkedIn, I'll think, wow, Neil thought about this. Maybe I should take a look at it. And if I see that your comment says congratulations, I think, what is this? Why should I read this? Mm-hmm. But instead, if I saw that you commented on an article, I agree. Moreover, in this kind of situation, this is what applies. Now there's some value there and there's some conversation going on. And that will make me interested enough to participate in the conversation. So I think you can see that being on LinkedIn means that you have to be a little more active. You have to put up information that is going to more fully describe your background, both visual and things that you have written. And you also have to be participating in the ongoing conversation by adding value and commenting in an intelligent way to make someone else want to respond or want to look into who is this Neil Tyra that has this great idea about this. And as I say, it's an acknowledgement to the organization that is hosting you that you are helping to drive attendance to the event. And then you take the photo and you thank them and you reiterate what the topics were so that you will continue to engage the people who are reading your posts and who are connecting to you and who are perhaps thinking that they ought to know more about you by visiting your website or having you talk to their group. So I hope that gives your listeners a better understanding of the power of LinkedIn, because if only 9% of your view of your connections are going to see what it is that you have to say, then you have to be more active in order to reach more people.
You know, one of the overused terms in the podcast world is value bomb, that she just dropped a value bomb on our listeners. I'm not very conversant in that with that phrase, but it seemed to be appropriate in that discussion regarding LinkedIn. There's so much that you provided there. Let me just ask you a couple of quick questions. If I had a post, I being random attorney listening on this podcast, if I had an article that I wrote as a post on my blog, for instance, and then I also used it in my newsletter, if it got particular traction in that arena, got some kind of interaction with those recipients, would it make sense then to take that, not maybe word for word, but in large part, and make that into an article on LinkedIn? As opposed to just posting a link to your blog post. Is there any value?
I think you could do that, because what you want to do is you want to share the discussion with a wider audience. I mean, my thought is that LinkedIn is in some way an electronic salon. Right. If you remember, there were back in, the early part of the 20th century, or maybe even earlier in France, there were these salons where people would gather and discuss the ideas of the day. Mm-hmm. Well, people that may not gather so much in living rooms and salons anymore, but they are discussing the ideas of the day through their activity on social media, whether it's Twitter or LinkedIn. So I think that sharing an idea and saying other people have commented X and Y, we have this discussion going on. And there are people who espouse that one should end a LinkedIn post with a question. What do you think? Comment below.
Interesting. Now, just mechanically so I understand, a LinkedIn article gets wider distribution than a post on your LinkedIn timeline.
No, that's not true.
It's not true?
No, that's not true. Okay. Anyone who goes to your profile can see articles that you have written by clicking on that part of your profile.
Oh, okay.
But only after you write the article and you put up a post that links back to the article, which will happen automatically when you publish the article. The post is what is going to be seen more widely.
I see. Okay.
So my understanding from those who have studied the question is that posts are read much more than articles. And so a post should drive someone to read the article if that is what you want them to do.
I see. The other thing that just really hit home with me, and I, again, I don't know why I have to keep pointing out my own foibles, but I am so guilty of this, of not following up after a speaking engagement. You know, I remember the last one I did, there was somebody else speaking at another point in the program, and I noticed they had a member of their staff taking pictures of them throughout the whole process, leading up to their approach to the podium, on the podium, off the podium, in the cocktail party afterwards. It was just a member of their staff with an iPhone taking photos of them. And then after the event was over, there was a whole series of posts showing the participation in that activity and linking back to the organization that sponsored it. And I thought, wow, I really missed the boat here. And this is exactly what you're talking about.
Right, right. So I actually wrote a newsletter a couple of years ago about making photos work for you. And I was focused on the nonprofit market. And I was thinking about an event that I attended where there was a photographer. And unfortunately, this was not part of my relationship with the client, but seeing that no one else was doing it, I made a point of hovering near the executive director and the photographer and pulling people in so that the photographer would take pictures of these individuals with the executive director. Now, it happened that this nonprofit focused on housing issues. So in attendance were representatives of certain real estate developers, certain banks, and the local city council member. And all of them, after the event, were sent copies of the photos so that they could use them in their communications, whether it was with regulators, right? Because banks have to lend a certain amount of money for CRA, for I forget what it means, but it has to do with community development. Mm-hmm. And because developers want to show that they are working on behalf of the neighbors and the community, and because the elected official wanted to show that she was out there talking to constituents. So if you like, I can share that article, with that newsletter with you about how to use photographs.
I think that would be tremendous.
But, yeah, but having a photograph of you speaking at the front of the room, it doesn't say very much to me. It just says, here's somebody who's speaking at the front of the room. Right. I mean, but having a photograph of you with the host organization's leaders, that would be something. Because then you would tag those people in the photo, both on Facebook and on LinkedIn. And then anyone who's connected to those people would then see the photographs and then would think, oh, Neil Tyrant, he speaks about wills. He was at this event. I'm a member of this organization. Maybe I should get in touch with him.
Yeah, much more strategic. Janet,
An iPhone works perfectly well for those photos. You don't have to have a professional photographer.
For sure. Well, Janet, I could pick your brain for another hour or so, but I need to let you get back to working with other clients. Tell our audience how they can reach out to you if they want to follow up and talk about anything that you discussed today in further detail.
Certainly. My website is Janet, J-A-N-E-T, L as love, Falk, F as France, A-L-K.com. JanetLFalk.com. And once there, they can review my newsletters and, you know, sign up if they'd like to get them monthly. I have many resources in the library, including 5 fast tips to maximize a media interview. And one of my tips, Neil, I want to point out, is that one should prepare ahead of time and print out one's ideas in 16-point font. And I confess, that is what I did before speaking with you. So I would have my ideas top of mind. Well, So check out the website, check out the newsletter, and check out the library, where there are a lot of resources to help you do better in your communications activities. Thanks so much for having me, Neil.
Well, it's been a real pleasure. And I will point out, I've been to the website. There's great information in the library, including some sample media profiles for attorneys, which I think is really important, because I know attorneys who say, okay, I'm going to update my profile, and they don't know where to start or what to do or how to make it happen. It's just so overwhelming that they don't do anything. So there's a lot of information there. And as you said, I have a newsletter specifically geared to the legal community and their communications and public relations needs and opportunities. And I think that positions you really very nicely for our audience. And I hope they do reach out to you. And I want to thank you for being a part of The Law Entrepreneur today.
It was my pleasure, Neil. If I could add one more thing about the media profile, and that is, I developed the media profile years ago, and I attended an event once where a reporter for a legal publication, one of the many Law 360 publications, specifically asked for a 50-word summary of what an attorney knows about a subject, so that he could determine whether or not it was worthwhile to call that attorney. So the media profile is something that reporters do want to see. They don't want to see your CV. They don't want to see your usual bio with your clerkships and your publications and your representative cases. They want to see 50 words to figure out whether or not it's going to be worthwhile to call that attorney. So thanks so much again, Neil, for having me.
Such valuable information. And Janet, thanks for sharing it with our audience today.
My pleasure.
Well, that will do it, fellow law entrepreneurs, for this episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors this week. That would be Ruby Receptionists, Jurisdiction. Be sure to visit us on our website at www.thelawentrepreneur.com. Or check us out on our social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, you name it. Just search for The Law Entrepreneur. You'll find us. Make sure you consider joining our private Facebook group, where we'll be having some new offerings starting the first of the year. So I want you to have a great week, and we'll see you next time. And thank you for listening to The Law Entrepreneur.